Hi, welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. It is Friday, April 12th, and I'm Jessica Steinberg. I'm speaking today with political correspondent Tal Schneider and Arab Affairs reporter Luca Pacchiani. Hi, good morning to you both.
Hi, Jessica. Good morning.
Hi, Jessica.
It is day 189 of the war. With U.S. intelligence indicating that Iran could strike Israeli soil in the next few days, the Pentagon is stressing full U.S. support to Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, to Israel. And Iran is also said to have told the U.S. that it will avoid a major escalation. Meanwhile, as negotiations for a hostage deal continue, a Wall Street Journal report stated U.S. fears that a good number of the hostages may be dead. We will talk about those topics, as well as Hamas operatives in Europe and an interfaith iftar at the end of Ramadan. All of that in today's podcast.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
Tal, talk to us about Iran. The IDF is on high alert. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu hints at retaliation if Iran does attack. U.S. embassy staffers are warned to limit their travel. What are the expectations? What is being talked about behind the scenes?
Right. So this is all coming as, a revenge attack or revenge threat due to Israel attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus on April 1st, in which a prominent Iranian general, Mohammad Reza Zahedi, was killed in Syria. Since then, since April 1st, it's like 12 days now, the Iranians are saying, we are coming back to get you. The threat is very specific about the way the attack should take place within the Iranian territory. So this is new because most of the time we are under attack from Iran. I mean, everybody know we are under attack from Iran at all times. It's just coming from Lebanon, from Syria, from Iraq, and from Yemen, and obviously from Gaza. Something that did not happen in these 6 months or ever is a direct missiles coming from Iran territory. So this is the alert as we speak right now. You know, according to Americans' intelligence, it should come within the next 24 to 48 hours. I mean, I don't know, Jessica, I just slept through the night, nothing happened. Let's hope for a quiet Shabbat. We don't know what's going to take place, but Israel's IDF spokesman, Hagari, took to the podium last night and said, this is a word to calm everybody down because we have air defense systems that are protecting us as it is. I mean, everybody knows that for 6 months we've been hit with missiles from everywhere. As I said, Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and the air defense system, you know, kind of traced most of them and nothing happened from that direction. I mean, almost nothing. Obviously, people were killed with rockets coming from Lebanon. But those long-range missiles were all traced and intercepted. So he said, you know, you shouldn't change your way of life. You shouldn't change. You shouldn't go into panic. You shouldn't stay in the safe room. Just, you know, stay the same. Be cautious. But, you know, we don't have anything else to pre-announce at this moment. And we also know that the American U.S. Central Command General Michael Kurilla is in Israel yesterday and today. on consultation. Again, it all has to do with the same event. And we got Biden's statement last night saying they are full on board with Israel with protection. And, you know, if the Iranians would take this step, they may encounter an American response. So that's what we all know.
Right. So there's not many details that we actually know, because that's the whole idea of an attack. I guess the other question I keep on wondering about is, yes, they're talking about a different kind of attack, but it could also end up being something else somewhere else on some other Iranian ground, correct? It could come from another direction, in a sense.
Exactly. So, right. For many, many years, tens of years, the Iranians would do things against Israel, attack Israel, not on Israel's soil. They would go after Israeli officials in embassies. We all know the famous attack on the Israeli embassy in 1992 in Buenos Aires, and then the 1994, major attack on the Israel's community building in Buenos Aires. Both attacks caused the damage and the devastation and killing of 97 people altogether were murdered. Most of them are Argentinians who were passerbys, by the way, but also Jews who were around and some embassy workers. Since then, Israeli embassies all around the world are on a high alert. They may try to attack Israelis who are traveling elsewhere, but right now they threaten to attack Israel soil coming from Iranian soil, which is very rare.
Okay. I guess we'll keep on sitting here and seeing what happens. Okay. We're switching gears to a very difficult and complicated statement that came via the Wall Street Journal, that as negotiations are continuing over the discussed 40 hostages in a first stage of a possible ceasefire, there are also reports that Hamas cannot locate 40. And what does that mean? What are the defense systems saying? What are we hearing from the government on this?
Right. So the initial negotiation, which seems to be going nowhere, but anyway, the negotiations were about the release of 40 hostages that are under specific circumstances, women, elderly, and sick. Apparently, the terror organization said in part of the negotiation that they don't have 40 people in that category. We know they have 18 women. We think that the 18 women are alive, but you know, going from the 18 to the 40, they may not have enough elderly and sick people, because one assumption is some of the elderly people were already, murdered by neglect in captivity. You know, there is the eldest is 86 years old, Mansour, from one of the kibbutz, and some of them, I think Perry is supposed to be 80 today. That's today is his 80th birthday. So those people may not have survived. The Hamas already claimed in the past that some of them are dead, but we didn't, you know, Israel's officials did not see any proof to that. So they are considered alive until proven dead. But having said that, from out of the 133 hostages, IDF has confirmed the death of 34. But as I said, Hamas has claimed for the death of others, and we don't know that for sure. So the numbers dropped. We don't know how far they dropped. I don't think the situation is that there's only 40 of them alive at all. I think it's more than that. But between the number of 97 and the number of 40, there is a big range, and it's a huge range. And apparently, out of the 97, not all of them alive. But you know, how low can you go? I mean, we don't know the numbers. So this is you know, some intelligence information, and again, Hamas has announced the deaths of some of them. And so we don't know. I mean, I suppose, Jessica, it's very hard to discuss this, but I suppose the younger people may survive. There's circumstances, but as when you go up with the ages, and we do have many that are above the age of 70, I think at least more than a dozen. as far as you, when you go up those ages, you know, the survival chances are slim. Without a daylight, without nutrition, without their medicines, without, you know, walking, they're, you know, according to reports, they're held in those kind of tunnels, cages or something. So we don't know the details for sure. They're not held in a courtyard and being, you know, giving food and water as people should be given.
Right. Although I was, I felt like sort of a little bit of hope yesterday. I was covering the mock Passover Seder at Kibbutz Neir Oz yesterday, where it was basically an opportunity to talk about hostages from Neir Oz and some who had been killed in captivity. And they were talking about one of the released hostages was talking about the fact that she was held in an apartment. But then again, hostage Elad Katsir, who was murdered in captivity. And he was held in an apartment, though. And that's what I was, you know, sort of, these are little details that get sort of dribbled out over time. But of course, we know so little. And that's exactly what this is all about.
Hamas says that some of them, and maybe even Elad Katsir, were, you know, they were bombarded by Israel's IDF because Israel's IDF don't know the specific location of all of them. Also, when you mentioned the Passover, the mock Passover, maybe we should also mention that there is an amazing video running yesterday with Chaim Perry, who's turning today to be 80 years old. And they put out a video of him from last year, Kibbutz Seder. He's on the stage, embracing the crowd of the kibbutz. Such a lovely person. It's really, really difficult to see those videos today when we're almost approaching Passover. And Chaim Perry, as I said, is held captive for more than half a year.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to turn for a moment, take a break, and we'll turn to Luca talking about Hamas and Hezbollah in Europe after just a moment.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
So Luca, you have a piece that just went up on the site about what this looks like. Hamas and Hezbollah operatives in Europe, in European countries for years, for decades. European countries aren't doing all that much to find or limit them. Talk to us about that.
European countries are basically turning a blind eye, knowing perfectly well that there's both a strong Hamas and Hezbollah presence around Europe, mostly Western Europe. I got the idea of the piece because I heard that there was a stash of weapons that was found in Bulgaria, which is actually in Eastern Europe, last week. And authorities managed to connect those to some Hamas operatives that were arrested in Germany and the Netherlands in December. And this is new. The fact that they were planning attacks on European soil against Israeli and Jewish targets. So that's a whole new level of danger for Europe. And that's why they're like slowly beginning to open their eyes. Because the Hamas presence and Hezbollah and until today was mostly focused, first of all, on fundraising. They set up all these charities for, you know, orphans in Gaza, and they collect money, and this way they can channel it legally through Gaza, and then it's used by Hamas for its terror purposes. Hamas is a very interesting modus operandi in Europe. We know that Hamas is an affiliate of the Muslim Brotherhood, and basically they follow the same pattern, which is that there's about a couple dozen very influential individuals. They're Palestinians with family ties to Hamas. And they go around Europe and set up these NGOs, Palestinians abroad, Palestinian students in France, things like that. And they managed basically to become the representative of the local Muslim community. They become very influential with the local Muslims. But they also address the European non-Muslim public opinion. You know, they write op-eds. They're invited on TV shows and interreligious dialogues, things like that. So they become very influential. And there's nothing really you can do about it. There was a recent case of a Palestinian man with British citizenship that set up first an NGO in London, then moved to Berlin, and the German authorities managed to prove, according to Der Spiegel, the German magazine, managed to prove that he's actually a Hamas member. And then, so he fled Germany and moved to Belgium and set up a new NGO there to, you know, promote dialogue between Palestinians and the European Union. And I spoke with a Jewish member of the Belgian parliament. He sent an inquiry to his own Minister of Justice in Belgium. And the Minister of Justice replied, like, candidly, yeah, we know there's a Hamas presence. We know they're fundraising. We know they're lobbying. But because they're not sending out extreme messages or extremist messages, we're not doing anything concretely against them. And he was understandably puzzled. He's like, Hamas has been outlawed throughout Europe. You know they're fundraising in Belgium and you're not doing anything about it.
Are they also involved in protests? Are they the ones who are making protests happen across Europe?
Absolutely, yes. So these NGOs, these organizations like Palestinians Abroad or whatever, you know, variations of that, they will often forge alliances with left-wing groups because they know that these movements can bring out a lot of people. They have a big pool of supporters. And definitely they're involved in mobilization, again, both of the local Muslim communities and of the wider population. They also organize annual conferences. And also the thing is, because they have all these little NGOs, it looks like there's a lot of them. So, you know, when they sign a petition, there's like 50 signatories. But they're all pretty much related to the same couple dozen key figures, basically. If you look behind all these NGOs, who's promoting these protests, who's promoting this mobilization, you will find that it's always the same constellation of people.
Is there any investigation being done by security forces in these countries, by the police? Is there any sense that there's more than just knowing that they're there and keeping an eye on them?
Okay, so opening legal cases against these people and against these NGOs is actually very hard. Again, because a lot of their activities are legal, you know, organizing a protest or starting a social media campaign is not illicit. And also because it's very hard to track the money. Sometimes the money is sent cash to Gaza, to the Middle East, or sometimes, you know, if it's through a charity, it's hard to prove that it's illegal. And often defense lawyers in Europe also, you know, if Israel will find some papers in a mosque in Gaza during a raid and say, oh, look, this is proof that this money came from Belgium, the Belgian defense lawyer will say, you know, like, how do we know this is true? There's no chain of custody. We don't trust the Israelis. So it's really hard. When it comes to Hezbollah, things are beginning to change, especially in Germany, which is the main hub of the Hezbollah, the Lebanese clans in affiliated with Hezbollah in Europe. There was a big raid a few weeks ago, and they're basically trying to dismantle the Hezbollah network, which is a lot more diffused than the Hamas ones. Well, the Hamas one is really in the hands of a couple dozen people, whereas the Hezbollah one is really, they try to set up a presence in all the Shiite communities throughout Europe, basically. And they raided 55 different mosques and religious centers in Germany. Again, there's a vast network of illicit economic activities of Hezbollah, much more than Hamas. So, you know, if you find the right evidence, it's also easier to indict the people.
Okay. And switching gears to something somewhat hopeful. As Ramadan ended, you attended an interfaith iftar, the celebratory meal that ends the month of Ramadan in Jerusalem, in Western Jerusalem. Who was there? What did you guys speak about? What did you hear?
So yeah, this iftar is an annual tradition organized by Interfaith Encounter Association. It's very nice. First of all, the place is wonderful. It's the Finnish Lutheran Center near the Old City. And there's basically what they do throughout the year is that people meet, Jews and Muslims and Christians, and I think there's also Druze and Baha'is somewhere in Israel. They meet and discuss interreligious affairs. You know, they compare the meaning of food and or music or in their respective religions. And they have this annual meeting where they all come together.
What was it like to do this right now, this year, in the middle of a war? Everyone is obviously at a high level of stress and worry and concern. What was it like to come together, different religions, at this particular moment in time?
So a lot of people said that they felt like it was a parallel universe because since the war started, people were entrenched in their own communities. You know, they don't go out as much meeting people from, you know, other parts of the city. And so they kind of feel that, you know, some people were afraid that, you know, this connection they had with people from other religions had somehow be broken. So they were very happy to come back together and see that, you know, the person-to-person relation is still there. So it was very important to have this annual gathering.
Is there a tension as well?
No, not at the iftar specifically, but some of the people reported that in the past few months, in some of these interreligious local chapters, there had been some tensions. You know, some people, some Muslims refused to condemn the October 7th attacks, stuff like that. So this is was what I heard from participants. But now things seem to be going okay. And some people noticed that actually this was towards the end of Ramadan. Someone said that it's actually been one of the quietest Ramadans that he remembered. People are going out of the way to show that, you know, we don't want the conflict to extend in Jerusalem, which is very important. And eventually, contrary to all the predictions, this is what ended up happening.
Yes, sort of a moment of ending of Ramadan. That was one of the quietest, which I know we also have a piece about, which is, you know, how that actually was able to happen. But you know, and you, I think you also noted that there was a waiting list, or it was, you know, they had to basically close off guests to the iftar because there were so many people who wanted to come.
Yeah, I think these people were really thirsty to just, you know, get together, get in this parallel universe of, you know, people from different religions and different ethnic groups coming together, sitting together in peace and quiet without, you know, thinking about what's going on in the outside world.
Right. An unlikely situation, but one that happened. Okay. It's good to note that those things can still happen. Well, Tal and Luca, it has been good to see you today and to have you speaking on the Daily Briefing. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you, Jessica.
And thanks to all of you for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. We'll be back again tomorrow after Shabbat. This episode is produced by the Podwaves. If you have comments about it or any other episodes, you can always drop us a line, podcast@timesvisual.com. Until next time, take care, be well, Shabbat Shalom.